Welcome to Living Above the Drama. I'm your host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio, and today my guest is David Longo. David is a wellness consultant, a foster parent, a motivational speaker, and the author of the book, Incorrigible, which tells his story of becoming an orphan at age 3 and the incredible journey it brought him through. Born on the Saugwin First Nation Reservation in Ontario, Canada, David was orphaned when he lost both his mother and father by the age of 3, and he spent the next few years in foster care and in an orphanage until he was adopted into a loving family. However, loss did not stop there, as David's adopted father, who he grew to trust and love, also passed away. His book, Incorrigible, is titled after what the health professionals that work with David termed him. Now a licensed social worker, David works within the field of health and addiction counseling, is also a foster parent and a wellness consultant. David, it's my absolute pleasure to welcome you to the show. You have quite the story.
Thank you.
I thank you for sharing it with us. Where to start? There's so much. Your story is, it's kind of complicated and complex, but why don't we start at the beginning? When we did our first interview together, you told me you were born in June of 1955 to the Songheen, I hope I'm saying it right, the Songheen First Nation, which is a native Indian tribe in Ontario, Canada. And you lived on a reservation up until the age of 3. Do you want to talk to us about that, describe that? Your dad was quite aged when he had you, and
yep.
It's quite a story about that. And then your mom, who unfortunately died quite young. So why don't you take us through that time?
Okay, first of all, thank you very much for this time and the time to be interviewed. I really, really appreciate it. I consider it an honor and a privilege to do this. The Saugeen First Nation in Ontario is where I was born in June of 1955. And I have 12 brothers and sisters, some of whom are 30 years my senior. And my dad was 86. You're right. He was 86 when I was born in June, and he passed away a month later in July of 55.
Wow.
Which left mom to care for the 3 youngest. My brother, I was the second youngest, and then an infant after that. Mom had her own struggles. She was deaf mute and could not speak, could not hear. And so I think my first language while being a child was sign language. And mom was killed on our reserve road when I was 3 years old by an impaired driver. And that was actually one of my first memories in my childhood. I think life before that was pretty carefree, and we were able to roam around a bit. And I remember being down by the Songheen River on occasion. But it launched us into a whole different world after my mom's death.
Right, and I understand you were with your mother when that accident occurred.
I was holding her hand with my left hand, and I remember the impact of that, the accident, almost taking my arm from my shoulder. And I remember all the chaos that pursued after that. And then my memory shuts down. And I want to tell the listeners that this is something I experienced many times in my childhood, loss of memory due to the trauma. And I don't recall a lot of things that I'm going to share, but I've researched a lot of my background, and a lot of it I'm clear on today, yes.
Right. So your mom couldn't hear and she couldn't speak. Do you think not being able to hear contributed to that fatal accident?
I think it played a role, but that doesn't excuse the person who was driving the vehicle from his behavior and his impairment at the time.
Certainly. Was he drunk? Was it a DUI?
Yes, it was.
Well, that is such a tragedy, David, but the tragedy just starts there. I mean, the thing about your story is, you know, you hear this really sad an unfortunate set of circumstances for you and your siblings and your older brother, you know, your just older brother. And you'd think, wow, isn't that enough for quite some time? But that's just the beginning of your story. So why don't you take us through what happened to you and Bernard? I believe that was your brother, older brother's name. And what happened to you? It's quite a nightmare, and anyone in social services would recognize exactly what you went through.
Yes, it was a nightmare, to put it mildly. When the accident occurred, within days, the Ontario government social service agency came into the reserve and took all three of us. Bernard was about a year and a half older. I was three at the time, and I had a younger brother, Alvin. And they made us what was called PGOs at the time, permanent guardian orders of the Ontario government. There was no waiting time for that to happen. It happened very, very quickly. And it was hence their role now to provide a nurturing, caring environment for us to live in. And we were right away launched into a barrage of foster homes. Within a year, and I say barrage, within a year of coming into care, first off, my younger brother was adopted right away, and I have not seen or heard or talked to this brother since, even to this day. But Bernard and I were kept together, and we experienced 18 different foster placements within 1 year. And at the during those placements, there was a lot of abuse and neglect that went on, and abuse in the form of physical, emotional, and sexual at the hands of our caregivers, and not to mention the revolving door process of coming into one home after another, 18 in 1 year. I don't have very good memories of those times. That continued to compound, I think, the impact of the loss of my mom and everything else. This made it worse. And at the end of the year, we were deemed unplaceable by the Ontario government. There was not another foster home in Ontario that would take us in.
Now we have to stop right there, because you've really got to expound on this. This is quite interesting. You were taken from your reservation without hesitation. You were placed in foster care. You were obviously traumatized, and as a result of that, you acted out. And what happened as a result of that is you became stigmatized. You and your brother were called incorrigible, meaning that you that people could not control your expressions or how you were grieving and how you were behaving. You had no intervention. You had no care in terms of what had happened to you. There was no family around you. There was nothing familiar. You were taken away and put into sometimes often abusive homes. And you became known as incorrigible. Nobody is going to take you. And so we have to take the next desperate step, which is to put you into an orphanage. Is that not correct?
That is extremely accurate. And after being termed incorrigible, which is obviously the title of my book and where the title came from, we were then housed in an orphanage probably about 45 minutes from my reserve. I didn't know that at the time. And we were housed with roughly 65 other homeless or orphans, much different ages, I should say. I was one of the youngest. And this is where my memory really starts to kick in, because I can detail the building and the place and where I slept, and I can detail what the backyard looked like. It was just phenomenal to me to be in this environment where I couldn't go anywhere. And the abuse didn't stop there. It continued. I was abused by older children, I was abused by the caregivers that ran the orphanage, and in physical ways, in emotional ways, spiritual ways, mental ways, and sexual ways. So it continued for almost another half a year that I was in that orphanage. And I just want to say that this is part of why I wrote my book, was to get my feelings out and my expression out and my journey out, because I really believe that there are many others that have similar experiences to mine, and I have found a way to get out of those and deal with them. So this is part of why I'm doing this. I think after the orphanage, life did start to change. And would you like me to touch on that aspect right now, too?
Well, yeah. I mean, I want the listener to be kind of clear that you went from a happy, carefree child on your reservation to becoming a very, you called yourself a bully. You said you were malnourished, you were abused on every level. You were obviously angry, frustrated, trapped, powerless. And so even at a young age, you lashed out and you became what you called a bully. So we've got you now up to, we are in the orphanage, and there's an Anglo family from Toronto, I believe, who actually gets in touch with the orphanage, hears about you and your brother. So why don't you take it from there? Because that's where it starts to turn and get a little better.
Yes, it does. Being in the orphanage left me with such a feeling of confinement and being controlled that, yeah, some of my behavior stemmed from that, where all the fear and all the loss and the hurt and the pain that I was experiencing was expressed in anger. But yes, there was a family in Toronto at the time that had lost a son of their own that particular summer, my fourth summer. And in their grieving, they decided as a couple to adopt one native child, which brought them, journeyed them to the steps of the orphanage in Ontario where I was. And when I was first told this, I got really excited, because I kind of wondered, how did I get selected from 65 other children, and my brother too? And the story goes very briefly that this couple, this French Canadian couple, came to the reserve and met the manager and were viewing photos and bios on all the children in the orphanage. And when they came to our pages in that particular book, the manager looked at the mom and dad, said, "You don't want these two. They're incorrigible, and there's no hope for them." And the mom stood toe to toe, and the mother, the wife, said, "You know, no child is incorrigible. I want you to bring both those boys to me right now." And this obviously, to the surprise of the manager, said, "Oh, okay, I'll go get them." And to kind of demonstrate just kind of where we were at emotionally and physically and how we were lashing out, she had one of us by the scruff of the neck and the other one by the scruff of the neck, and was holding us at arm's length as we were spitting and biting and trying to kick her and yelling and screaming and all this stuff. And this is how I met this French-Canadian family. And I don't remember that. The mother told me about this later, but I said, "What happened?" Because I was there, but I don't recall this. And she goes, "I fell in love with you." And I want the listener to really understand the power of love, and especially unconditional love, because that couple within a week or two adopted both my brother and I and took us from that orphanage and brought us to our new home in Toronto.
Wow. That must have been, what was that like for you? I mean, it's kind of like being rescued from hell, isn't it?
It definitely is. I always believed, and I've always said, they saved my life, and it was definitely a hell we were saved from, because I don't think any child should be in this kind of living situation, no matter what has happened to them.
Exactly.
But yes, but that doesn't end the trauma that we are going through. We moved from reserve to 18 homes to an orphanage to the big city of Toronto, all in about 4 years. And the city was different than anything else we'd ever experienced, and all of our neighbors and family members and extended family members, and we eventually went into schools. All of our schoolmates were different than we were, in that we were the only First Nation children in that community. So there's a whole shift of trying to understand how we got here and understanding the whole adoption thing, but also, you know, welcoming it at the same time, and also carrying all this emotional trauma and hate in our system. So, So the Longos were an amazing patient couple. I mentioned in my bio and in my book that it took a miracle to undo or to straighten out all the wrongs that had happened up until then. And they were the only couple, I think, that could have done it. But they had to put up with a lot. And we had some very trying experiences entering the public system in Toronto. And when I say I became a bully, that's when my feelings of anger started to be lashed out at other people, including, schoolmates and people that became friends. I often hurt them. And it just seemed like I couldn't control any given moment how I would react or how I would feel about something. My emotions at that time ruled what I did, and I would flip-flop between anger and sadness and fear and rejection and anger and more sadness, more anger, and back and forth like a yo-yo, and I could not control them, nor could I really understand the school system and the structure of school and the academic side of things. And I was I had a very difficult time learning right through all of my public school years. There's an event that took place when I was in our home, our new home, and I was 8 by this time. It was November of 1963, and it was that time in November that I woke up to find out that my adopted dad had died in the plane crash the night before. And at age 8, I just about went nuts, because I love this man, and he did a lot in a very short years with me, and I grew to respect him, and I grew to love another man, which many of our young children don't have that experience. I did, and I'm lucky, but I was also scared, and I was also angry, and I was also fearing what would happen. I immediately thought we'd be removed again. But Mom, being who she was, kept us all together and got us through that. And I didn't say anything to anybody for years and years about that.
Wow. You know, David, one would think at this point that your story was going, the badness, the sadness, the tragedy of your story was going to end there. 8 years old. You've lost all these people. You've been through so much trauma, so much change, so much hurt. But that was just the sunrise on what was soon going to become years of more suffering and addiction.
Yeah.
And that is that's an amazing story, and that's an amazing chapter. And what we're going to do, we're going to take a break, because I can't believe the entire first part of the show, the first break of the show has passed. That's how really fascinating your story is. So we're going to take a short commercial break. We're going to come back, and we're going to invite you. I mean, this is really a remarkable story. You know, I believe in angels, and I believe in miracles. Always have, always will. And I think that your story is such a testimony to the human heart and the human spirit and the desire for love and for peace and happiness. And so when we come back, we're going to knock on the door of your many, many years of addictive suffering and go through that part of the story with you. Listeners, don't go away. We're going to come back very shortly and talk more with David about his journey.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful, pure presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donatio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-4325.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donatio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donatio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way. What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they've brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
Today we're talking to David Longdo. David is a wellness consultant, he's a motivational speaker, a foster parent, and he's author of the book Incorrigible, which tells about his story of becoming an orphan at age 3 and the incredible journey it brought him through. David, before the break, we were talking about, as you know, one thinks, oh, how could anything get worse? Okay, here's this 8-year-old boy. He's been, you know, he's really gotten kicked in the pants by life. His second father dies. His first father died immediately after he was born. You have to be thinking, you have to be having these imprints in your little brain that everything you love dies, and all of these traumas, you know, that it's somehow your fault or you don't deserve to be loved and all those terrible things that happen to people. So you're 8 years old and you've got a single mom, you've got your brother. Tell us what happens and how you get to be 12 years old and be a substance abuser by the time you're 12 years old.
Right. When dad passed away in 1963, he left behind a whole family. It's his wife, my mother, an oldest daughter, 11 years old, And then my brother was, my natural brother was the next oldest. And then I followed him in age at age eight. Then I had a younger sister, Michelle, who was six, and a little brother who was born only 2 years before my dad's death. So he was two. Mom was left to care for all five of us, and two of us were out of control. Now, that didn't stop. We had problems through schooling, through neighbors, through fights, through police, and everything. We were stealing things. We were involved in things. And I want to say to the listener that back in the mid, well, early 60s, addictions were quite wild and rampant then. But my first use became around age 12 when I first started smoking cigarettes. And then very quickly was introduced to sniffing solvents and airplane glue. And to demonstrate what happened, I could not stop sniffing, meaning I would sniff, well beyond the point of being impaired to almost to the point of being unconscious.
Oh, my.
And yes, and that's how quickly that process developed. I was addicted right from my first experience with any kind of chemical in my system. Very quickly that I was introduced to alcohol, and I blacked out the first time I drank. And I had a notion at that time, at that experience at age 12, that I was in serious trouble because I could not recall what I did, what I said, who I was with, how I acted. And that really concerned me because I knew deep down inside that there was still a lot of anger and unresolved stuff happening there that I could not control, and I had no means to express it. But that was just a catalyst to a barrage of different drugs, including marijuana and hashish at first, and I would smoke as much as I could, and sometimes daily. Sometimes I'd be going to junior high school and smoking on the way to school in the morning. So that kind of illustrates the impact that substance abuse had on me really, really quickly. I launched into a career with mescaline, with MDA, which is now speed, or crystal meth, they call it now. LSD, I must have done about 60 trips on LSD in the next couple of years. And each one of these drugs did something different for me, but it helped me escape my reality and the reality around me. But the other edge to that sword was I could not predict what my behavior would be like. And sometimes I took that behavior out many times on other people, and it was also self-inflicted, where I'd end up cutting myself or getting stitches in my left hand, and a dozen or so stitches in my left hand, burning myself with some of my friends. And there was a shared kind of approach to substance misuse. And we used to do these things in groups, in our small group, a gang of very close friends we had. And together we were all unpredictable. But I found the friends I wanted and friends I felt comfortable with. And I think to this very day, all of us are either in recovery or have passed away due to their addictions.
Wow, that's quite a statistic, huh?
It is 100% in recovery or dead, and right from the get go. And I need to make that clear because I know some theorists might challenge my views in terms of the addiction process, and I could on another half hour explain some of those theories. But I'm talking about myself, David. I'm talking about the person who experienced these things and how quickly I became attached and dependent on them, and it happened overnight. So basically what happened is I stumbled through the rest of junior high, they call it, or senior public, they call it back in Ontario, up to grade 7 and 8. And by the time I was completing grade 8, I was not accepted, nor was I referred to any other high school in metropolitan Toronto, based on my performance, my behavior, the level of my grades. I was behind in everything, and my behavior was really what stood out.
David, how did your mother cope with all of this? I mean, she's a single parent. Her husband, her beloved husband, has passed away. How did she cope? Did she have any help, or what was the support that she had to go through all of this?
Well, you know, I don't know if there's any professional support for her. She had a cast of friends and relatives and so on that she could go to or talk with or lean on. But some of those individuals were upper middle class people, and they would respond to her with such things like, "Don't worry, Judy. You have to understand they're natives." And things that they didn't understand about us too was, yeah, we were native, but we weren't actually practicing our culture or our heritage. As a matter of fact, we're very far removed from it. So the help she got was the help she sought, and she did get some. She had an incredible strength though that needs to be mentioned. And she was a very religious lady in that she prayed all the time, and she went and attended church all the time. Took me through that process within the Anglican faith, and I was confirmed, and I was baptized, and everything else. But her strength was incredible. Like her belief system and her value system was based on her relationship with God. And I've witnessed this many times. So she would reach her wit's end, I'm sure, many times. But you know what? She had an open door policy, meaning that we always had a home to come to. There would always be food in the fridge for us. And there'd always be a message somewhere along the line that I love you and I care about you. You try and be careful, or is there anything I can do? Is there, you know, da 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 da. And that was consistent throughout that whole process. And her love, her unconditional love, is what I took in.
Now, David, how old were you at this point of the story?
I'm about 13, maybe going on 14. So I've been
all those drugs.
Yep.
All those drugs in this period of time.
That's correct.
And you survived it, because that was a lot, wasn't it?
It was a lot. It was way too much at times. I overdosed many times, and I'm lucky. Somebody was watching over me during those times, and it was sometimes a friend that walked me through it, or it would be a higher power that I understand to be God, or that stayed with me during that time, because there are times I didn't think I would live, and maybe I shouldn't have, but I did. So going through all that and knowing myself, I took a lot of anger and a lot of my trauma out on myself by actively using and hurting myself and others. So that process continued, that cycle continued well into my 17th year. And it was around that time where I decided that, I have to do something with my life. And I had only got through the grade 9, and somebody had recommended Seneca College to me, and I listened, and they said there's a program there that might be helpful for you, and I listened, and they said it's called the College Preparation Program. I heard them, and they said it's only about 8 months long, and it can get you ready for college, and that seemed to be something I could handle, and I'm so grateful that person shared that with me, because I went into the college, and for the first of many times after that, I was welcomed, and I was recommended on the stuff that I was doing, and I was commended on my behavior. I was exemplary in some areas of my studies, and one outing took us out to visit a seniors center in Toronto. I don't recall where it was, but it was an evening kind of an outing with all of my classmates, and we went there. And I don't remember, even to this day, I don't recall being there. And it wasn't that I was stoned or I was too drunk. I just don't remember this experience. But the next day I came into school, and I was really feeling shy and reserved and in within myself. And because I didn't know how I had acted at this place. And that whole blurred when I came out of it. My classmates and my instructor said, "What happened to you?" I said, "What do you mean?" And they said, Well, you should have seen the way you were with these elderly people." I said, "Well, how was I? I don't know what you mean, because I really backed out.
You didn't remember,
and,
yeah.
No, I couldn't recall. And even my classmates were saying, oh, Dad, you're just totally different, and you're outgoing, and you're, you know, you're laughing, and you're playing with them, you're joking around, da da da. And it was amazing to watch, they all said. And I said, oh, my God. Now I felt really embarrassed because some part of myself was exposed that I had tried to keep hidden for a long time.
David, I think that this is an important point of the story to kind of take a closer look. You go off to this college prep program,
yeah,
and all of a sudden you focus on performing well, doing your best, and move away, not completely, but move away from the kind of, you know, anger and addiction and, you know, kind of over-focused, obsessive behavior that you had before. It didn't all go away, but you were able to regroup yourself. What do you think it was about going off to this program? And did your mom, was she paying for this? Or how did that come about? How were you allowed to be able to do that program?
My mom was actually one who found it. Now that you mention it, she's the one who located it. I don't know how, but and I checked it out and talked to some people, and it came highly recommended, and it sounded like it was for, well, shall I say, underachievers, people that hadn't had much success academically, and I certainly fit that bill. It was covered through my own treaty status at the time, because mom was on a very strict budget with five kids, and she was living off insurance money from my dad's of death, and so we were able to access some of that money to help pay for our education. And it was during that process that I found out I was TB status, because I didn't know that. And
what status
the band
was that? What is
TB status?
Yeah. What is so that?
Well, treaty status means that I'm a registered member of a reserve or a band, and that I have a treaty number, which is connected to that band and its membership. And that status allows me to access education, medical supports, glasses, hearing, dental, whatever, without any cost. And so this came as a huge surprise, because we touch base with them, and they ended up picking up the cost of the course for the year, and knowing that it would help me get somewhere, or that at least I was trying to do something productive, and which is what I did. And I completed that program in April of 1973, and I'm only 17 at the time, but I have some idea. Somebody planted an idea that I could possibly work with people. Now, even going through the heydays of my teens, when I was living in my mom's home there as a teenager, there were thousands of hours that I spent with the children in the neighborhood during my sober time. And I was basically volunteering, playing games, street hockey, organizing trips to the Toronto Island, and just doing all number of things. Because these little people looked up to me, and something that I latched onto dearly, but I became their figure, their role model, if you will, during the day. They didn't know at nighttime that I was self-destructing. I didn't let them see that part of me. So the people in the college reaffirmed that, and I graduated. And within a month and a half, within a month, May 24th, long weekend of 1973, I accepted a position as a child care worker in a group home in central Alberta, not knowing what I was going to do, where I was going there, where I would stay, and all these things that were really, up until that time, really important to me.
Right. So let's pause at that point, because it really deserves and almost demands a recap. You go from age 3 to about 18, going through 15 years that could only be described as torturous. You come out the other end with an education and a purpose, and you go out into the world of social work, really, at a very young age, at a very, very young age. And you were still addicted, you were still abusing substances, you said, throughout that time, and it wasn't until the age of 28 years old
That's correct.
something happened to that. So I just want to paint the picture for the, you know, for the listener. You know, you've come through a terrible time, and you're functioning. You're actually a functioning addict, and you're doing a good job with what you're doing, but, you know, you're also self-destructing. Talk to us about what happened at age 28 when you wound up in the hospital and got in touch with your trauma, ultimately to go back to college and to become a social worker.
Well, it's the roller coaster ride between 12 and 28. It could be we could spend hours on that roller coaster ride with addictions. But what happened to me is I entered the profession of child care work at age 17 and did extremely well. I moved out to Alberta in 76 after 3 years of work and was hired on with the government out in Alberta as a therapy counselor working with teenagers. So the success continued, but I was still part-time employee and three-quarter-time drug addict. And what happened is I carried on that little facade until I could not carry it on anymore. Eventually, both those worlds were going to collide, and they did at my job. I hit what we all call a rock bottom, and it was a bottom because I spent many days on the streets in Edmonton sniffing and snorting and eating and drinking and whatever I can get my hands on. Left my job, a full-time job with the Alberta government, and went out on a suicide mission. After 11 days, I realized I could not control it. I needed help. I went and sought it, and I ended up in the detox center in downtown Toronto, where I first grabbed onto the reality that I'm a drug addict, I'm an alcoholic. These are the two things I need to stay clear of. There is hope for me if I do that. I will die if I don't. So I did something rather unique, and when I change my mind and I decide to stick to something, I do. I went to detox, and after that, I voluntarily checked myself into a psychiatric day program with the Alberta Hospital, and I continued. I entered a therapy process that kept me in the groups and in the individual counseling 8 hours a day, 5 days a week for almost, well, just over 7 months before I graduated from that program. And all this is with clear eyes and a clear conscience, and I'm starting to feel like really strong about myself. I began using again after that for a period of about 5 years, and I hit another bottom in 1983, and it was worse than the one I just described. I attempted suicide on that particular Thursday evening, and I woke up December 15th, 1983. I realized that all the work that I had done in the hospital and all the self-healing I'd done, I just kind of blew it apart, and addictions were going to take over, and I would die if I didn't do this. So I resolved from December 15th, 1983, that I would never touch another substance, another drop of alcohol or anything, and I would do everything I could in my power to get better. And that's what I've done for the past 35 years.
Wow. First, let me say congratulations. Secondly,
thank you.
We have to take another break, but
that's fine.
When we come back, you told me that you wrote this book because you wanted to talk about the incredible healing power of unconditional love.
Yes.
And about the power of recovery and healing, and suicide ideation, which, you know, that's kind of an interesting topic. But when we come back, I would love for you to focus on, I mean, since that time, was it 1983, I believe, right?
Yep, that's correct.
December the 15th, which I'm sure is a very big, anniversary for you.
Yes, it is.
You have committed yourself to a very large task, which is to remain in a relationship with yourself first and foremost, to have
That's
a
correct.
Relationship with yourself. because we really can't love anyone else if we don't love ourselves. And so when we come back, let's talk about that. Let's talk about unconditional love, self-love, recovering and healing, because that's all interconnected. And for anyone who's listening who struggles, we all struggle. We all struggle with, you know, we kind of think that drug addiction is somehow different from relationship addiction or work addiction or, you know, any other addiction that we're going through. But the roots of all of those addictions are really the same. So you have a lot to share with us. We're going to take a short break. Listeners, don't go away, and we'll be back with more of David's story.
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way.
What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they've brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donadio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donadio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful pure presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-4325.
And we are back with David Longdo, who is an amazing and remarkable man who's done all kinds of wonderful things and has written a book called Incorrigible, which actually tells his story. David, you were also born under a different name.
That's correct.
Yes, do you want to tell us your native name? I think we should honor that as well.
I have several names. My birth name was Alfred Patonicot. Obviously my adopted name is David Longo. And I also have a special name that was given to me by my elder here in Alberta, and that is Thunder Voice. And he was one who blessed me to continue sharing what it is I've been through and what it is I've experienced with as many people as I can, because he too believes that there is some help for other people in that process. So I have three names.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, you know, names mean things, and I'm sure that all of your names have been energetically very helpful for you. Before the break, we talked about, you know, this whole process. You call it process. I love that. We say process, you say process. about your process of discovery, which started actually through the terrible pain and suffering, and what you referred to in the pre-interview as the suicide ideation, you know, this idea of destroying the self. And when we, you know, drill down into self-destruction, we actually find the opposite is self-love and unconditional self-love. So talk to us about how you bounced back from suicide ideation from the last time that you had, you know, a very long addiction episode, and what you learned about unconditional love and about recovery and healing.
In 1983, December 15th, I regained consciousness to an understanding that if I ever used it again, there's a likelihood I would die. I then realized I had to get some help and serious help and stick with it. So my first knock on the door was with Alcoholics Anonymous, who readily accepted me in, and I began sharing some of my pain with them right away, and realized that that they were understanding of it, number one, but also welcoming me back, number two. I'd run out of doors to open at that time and friendships to go back to. I realized at that point in time that when I make up my mind to do something, I do everything I can to get to that goal. And I've always had that in me. I just had to come to this point to practice it. I started my healing in AA. I went to meetings in NA. And eventually CA, which is Cocaine Anonymous, and Crystal Meth Anonymous. I've been to meetings as well. So I've been to a whole barrage of meetings. And if I was to, I once sat down and discovered to my own calculations, I've been to over 7,000 meetings since 1983. And that was the catalyst to change, because in a clear and sober state, all I had to look at was me. If I was really serious about getting better, I had to look at me. And that process that I went through in recovery with the meetings and the sponsorship and the people that helped me, they guided me through a process that has helped me to stay clean and sober to this day. But that's only one part of the puzzle. The other part was that I have trauma and all kinds of thoughts, uncontrollable thoughts, even in recovery. And it was doom and gloom throughout the earlier parts of it. I really struggled with the abstinence of alcohol and drugs and exploring me. So I got other help. I went to psychologists. I was in counseling, individual counseling. I've been hypnotized. I was introduced to depression medication, which I think also saved my life. I went and got involved in the exploration of my heritage, and with the Cree people's help here in Alberta, I've attended over 200, almost 300 sweat lodge ceremonies and other ceremonies that foster well-being. Mm-hmm. And help you let go of things that are in the way.
Isn't that also part of the medicine circle, the sweat lodge and all of that? Isn't that?
Yes, it is.
Yes, wonderful.
Yes, it is. And being First Nation and realizing this at, you know, at age 28 and 29 and 30, that this is the first experience I had with my heritage. So I felt I had a lot to cover up and a lot to catch up on because I was a late bloomer, and so I'm now implementing a therapy regime, if you will, that consists of Western therapies and lots of it with First Nations healing ceremonies. And because I'm a product of both communities, they both fit for me. So I ate it up. I graduated from college in social work. I continued my own journey with healing. At the same time, I continued helping others. Every day has gotten incredibly better. I can't even fathom right now as we're speaking just how incredible life is and how somebody way, way back taught me how to give and unconditionally. And that means there's to me that there's no strings attached to that love and that caring. Mm-hmm. That means to me you do it because you want to do it, because it's in you to do it. You do that because you were taught to do it. And it gets me out of me. Even to this day, all I have to do is spend 5 minutes with one of my foster children, and I'm in a different realm altogether, and I feel better, and I love my life, and I love my children, I love my wife. But it all hasn't been a bed of roses, and I need to express that to the listener, because I see a lot of people coming into recovery and not making it. And I think the statistics of people who recover is very, very low, and I'm going to throw out 2% right now. And so there's lots that are not making it. And I really believe, in my experience, that it's because when they come into therapy or into the safety net of an AA meeting and they clean up for a little while, they have to look at themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
And luckily, I was able to latch on to supports to help me get through that because I needed it dearly. And some people are not able to take that next step into the journey. And hence, they relapse and go back to what's familiar, what's comfortable, which puts them back where they feel they should be or they deserve to be.
The triggers are really, they are the shadowed self. You know, you can get better and be buoyed up and feel good, but then something's going to come along to trigger that unconscious pain again. And so, yes, we have to go inward. It really is, as you would say, a process, because without going through that, without drilling down and digging up the demons, I think that's what Star Wars was all about. Remember when Luke goes into the forest, he cuts off the head of the monster, you know, which is Darth Vader, and he realizes it's himself. So that is something that we're all dealing with. We only have a couple of minutes, and I just have to ask you this because I think it's, and maybe the listeners are wondering, do you find that you're healing yourself and reparenting yourself by being a foster parent? I'm sure that, you know, that is a really critical thing and a big thing for you to find yourself a foster dad after what you've been through.
You know, I had to do all that rehealing and readjustment myself before I could become a foster parent. Being a foster parent for the past 8 years has only reinforced what I've found out about myself during my journey, is the fact that I have the ability and the capacity to love unconditionally. There's children that there's a child in my home who I identify with every day, emotionally and mentally, and because he is fostered too. He's fostered, but he has no mom or dad. And we have some amazing times together, as with the other kids. But I have that ability, and I feel good about what I do. And I know I make a connection with everybody that I'm in touch with. And that's something that's been pointed out for many years, that I was given a gift somewhere along the line of sharing my pain and helping others with theirs.
Well,
so.
David, you have done a brilliant job of sharing your story with us today, and it really drives home the lesson that no matter how broken or wounded or traumatized or damaged any of us are, there really is, on the other side of that terrible, terrible hell, there really is the most wonderful experience of love, self-acceptance, and unconditional love. And you have really given us a tutorial on that today. And I can't thank you enough for coming on the show and sharing it with us.
You're very, very welcome, and I thank you very much for the opportunity. I wish all the listeners a happy, safe, sober life. I do.
Thank you, David. And listeners, don't forget to join us again next week for another uplifting, inspiring, and educational show here on Living Above the Drama.